Hello and welcome to the Slate Political Gabfest. For July 21st, 2022, it's the hot, hotter, hottest edition. I am David Plotz of CityCast. I'm in Washington, D.C. Emily Bazelon is, I hope, somewhere cooler. And in her stead, we are so pleased to have Josie Duffy Rice, Gabfest regular. She is a writer sweltering in Atlanta. Hello, Josie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And John Dickerson is also a writer and many other things for CBS News, sweltering in New York City. Hello, John.
Hello. Heat, hot.
That's thunder for you, me. Josie.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
There's something special about a morning thunderstorm, though, that is, we had one in New York this week, and it's, I couldn't put my finger on it, but there is something both magical and terrifying about a morning thunderstorm.
This week on the Gabfest, the catastrophic heat waves devastating Europe and the United States and what they herald for our future. Then did Joe Manchin destroy Joe Biden's presidency, the Democratic agenda, and also human civilization? Is he personally responsible for the end of human civilization? We will discuss what Manchin is doing and has done this week. Then the consequences of Dobbs, a drastic decay in healthcare for pregnant and miscarrying women, have become evident across the country. We will talk about the confusion that the Supreme Court's decision has unleashed across the land. Plus, we will have cocktail chatter.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title the Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of four episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this, for me, is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.
In Ministry for the Future, I don't know if you guys have read this novel. It's Kim Stanley Robinson's 2021 novel about climate change. It begins with this horrifying scene. It's a really epic set piece scene where a heat wave grips central India and it drives temperatures beyond human endurance. Power fails, and people who are unable to cool themselves die by the millions. It is like an unforgettably terrible image. If there's one thing that sticks with me from that novel, it is this incredible image of this heat wave in India. And the heat waves we're seeing in Europe and the United States are obviously not like that. They are a mild preview, however, of what is to come for the planet. The U.S. infrastructure for now seems stable enough that the heat wave that is affecting 200 million of us probably will not kill too many people, probably won't disrupt life too much, but it will create sort of unpleasantness and misery. In Europe, by contrast, 2,000 people are already dead from the heat just in Spain and Portugal alone. And kind of more alarmingly, the infrastructure that was not built for heat is in danger. So, John, this heat wave will pass. Like, seasons come, seasons change, it will pass in Europe. Do you think there are likely to be any long-term policy consequences that come out of this single event, or have we gotten past that point and people have just kind of given up on the hope for structural change?
I think there will be policy consequences in Europe. There will likely not be policy consequences in the States right now at the federal level. And it also depends on what we mean by policy consequences. I mean, in some sense, there have been policy consequences if Joe Biden is able to get his executive orders put in place to improve emergency response in urban areas to high heat wave. That's a policy response. It's just not one that gets at the underlying issue. What Biden announced on climate was all mitigation measures, with the exception of some wind farm stuff. But $2 billion for infrastructures to make cooling spaces is dealing with the fire, not what caused the fire. In Europe, they are making the link between climate change and these issues more directly. But you see the big clash in Europe, which is less acute than we have here, but nevertheless, we see it, which is all the measures that were being taken to anticipate or deal with climate change as a long-term threat are running up against domestic problems. I think of the farmers in the Netherlands who are protesting various policies that are meant to cut emissions. And their argument is you're killing our livelihoods. So they face the same pressures there. But there is much more likely to be a response than here, where Biden is seeing his ambitious agenda basically shrivel.
The temperatures in Europe are very high, but the United States deals with temperatures like this all the time. Dubai deals with temperatures like this all the time. Why is it so catastrophic for Europe to face this?
Right. I mean, one part of it is that a lot of people in Europe don't have air conditioning, right? I mean, there's sort of like this basic infrastructure issue that so many people in the U.S. have access to that they don't really have in Europe. And you can imagine, like, you know, you hear like 103 degrees. I'm like, yeah, that's bad. But I've seen that a couple of days in my
Georgia
life.
That's a Tuesday in Atlanta.
Yeah. But, you know, without air conditioning, and then you think about people at risk, especially elderly people and kids, like, it's just unbearable. My friend Madison Condon is a law professor at BU, at Boston University. Her focus is kind of like the market's response to climate change. And one of the things she notes is that a number of kind of financial institutions like BlackRock and Bank of England and places like that, you know, are warning, right, that that markets are not actually like pricing in climate change risks into their asset prices and into thinking about how they think about the future. And so it's interesting to sort of think about how like corporate America might actually be taking climate change more seriously in the long term, even if they're not doing it particularly well yet, if markets are actually considering climate change better than our own elected officials.
But it is interesting that markets don't even bother to do it. I just read this novel. In fact, I'm talking about it on Gabfest Reads next month, Invisible Things by Matt Johnson, which is an allegory. And it's an allegory about a colony on Jupiter. It's not really about the U.S., but it is about the U.S., and it's about why we're incapable of looking at horrors, why we are incapable at actually looking at something that is existentially horrifying in the face. When we were kids, at least when John and I were kids, we were a little bit older than you, Josie, we had nuclear war hanging over us, and I guess I did think about that, but I feel like nuclear war actually is relatively small compared to climate change as an impact.
Look at things like electric cars. I mean, the move to electric cars is happening. The sales of electric cars are climbing sharply. Tesla is, you know, the hottest car on the market right now. All of that is a market reaction. Whether people who are buying it like them because they're cool or like them because they are not going to contribute to climate change, the market's creating an opportunity.
I would just say the market's response is pretty mild compared to the threat that the world faces. So there are companies, but BlackRock is kind of a famously liberal financial institution. Not famously liberal, but it's famously progressive in how it deals with these things. It is one institution that is taking this into account and pricing it. The ones that are not are much bigger, and there are many more of them.
My understanding from my friend's scholarship, please do not conclude that I've drawn any of these conclusions myself. My understanding is that they are starting to kind of consider this data and incorporate it into their own long-term predictions and sort of value-based judgments. But that being said, like, they don't always use the right data. Often they use outdated data. Their incentives are misaligned. Corporate America thinks short term. They're myopic. They think about like personal profit over, you know, what's best for people overall. And so in some ways, like, the two goals are kind of at odds with each other. So I think it's both good. And I think if you are someone who's worried about climate change, like we are, it almost feels like anything is a gift because we've spent so long doing absolutely nothing. But it still just feels like we're so behind in actually being willing to address the problem, much less actually addressing the problem.
John, to close this out, there's this foo-foo-rah about whether President Biden should declare a climate emergency that he has not yet done. What would it mean for him to declare one? Why does he keep hesitating?
What it would mean is it would basically allow him to bypass Congress to change some laws. Essentially, I think one of them has to do with exporting U.S. oil, which and basically act more unilaterally in addressing climate change. I think they're worried about legal challenges to that, but I'm not quite sure. And it seems like he is going to go ahead take emergency action. So I don't really quite know why he didn't do it the first go round, but they seem to be signaling that he is going to declare a formal climate emergency. One other thing, and maybe we'll get to this in the Manchin piece, but just on the question of collective action to meet long term threats, while Biden's climate agenda is dying in Congress, Congress is nevertheless taking action on the CHIPS Act, which is an effort to increase U.S. production of semiconductors. That's an acute problem that's happening right now, but that problem is getting better. And the CHIPS Act is only going to help in like 5 years because it takes a long time to create these chip factories. So, and why are they taking action? Because the lobbying is on the side of the chip manufacturers. It can also be framed as a competition against China. Whereas with climate change, the lobbying money is on the side of the U.S. producers. And so we shouldn't forget the role that that lobbying plays in keeping any U.S. response bottled up.
Slate Plus members get bonus segments on the Gabfest. They get member-exclusive episodes on shows like Slow Burn. You get no ads on any of our podcasts if you are a Slate Plus member. And we do a bonus segment, as I said. And this week's bonus segment, we're going to talk about what summer teaches us, our summer memories of childhood, what we learn from summer, childhood summers. So go to slate.com/GabFestPlus to become a member today. This episode of the Gabfest is sponsored by Aura Frames. Are you ready to win Mother's Day? Cement your reputation as the best gift giver in your family? Give the moms in your life an Aura digital picture frame preloaded with decades of family photos. That mom will love looking back on childhood memories, seeing what you're up to today, checking out grandkids, checking out cousins. And even better, with unlimited storage and an easy-to-use app, you can keep on updating your mom's frame with new photos so that it's a gift that keeps on giving. This is how I live in my family. I gave my mother an Aura frame. It was either for Mother's Day or for her birthday. She absolutely adores it. She's constantly hectoring me to update it with more photos, which I do. I also gave my girlfriend's mother an Aura frame, and I hope she hectors my girlfriend to update it with more photos. But it is a present that will bring absolute delight to a mother in your life. And they have a great deal for Mother's Day. Gabfest listeners can save on this perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code GABFEST at checkout to save. Terms and conditions apply.
If you want to understand what is happening in the United States right now, you really need to understand what's happening with the courts, the law, and the Supreme Court. The battle between democracy and whatever this cage match is that we're witnessing, it's going to be won and lost at the ballot box, but it's also going to be won and lost in the courtrooms. I'm Dahlia Lithwick. I host Slate's legal podcast, Amicus, and we are doubling our output, bringing you weekly episodes from here on in, because how else can we keep an eye on the many trials of Donald Trump, the conservative legal movement's assaults on our rights, the Supreme Court's latest slate of environmental gutting, gun safety eviscerating cases on the docket? So follow Amicus wherever you get your podcasts, new episodes dropping every Saturday morning.
John, to hear some people on the left tell it, Joe Manchin is either the worst person since Stalin, maybe just the worst, second worst person after Putin on earth. He has betrayed the Democratic Party, betrayed Joe Biden. He has also doomed the planet to a Dantean hellscape for eternity because he will not step forward to do what? How correct is this sort of hyperbolic response to what Manchin has been doing this week?
Well, I think specifically on the question of climate change, I think the the argument rests on a couple of things. One, Manchin has been resistant to argumentation when it comes to things like, you know, whether you can keep producing coal but do it in a cleaner way. He believes you can. The consensus of scientists is that the measures that he believes in are impractical and won't provide the results that you want. So that's at the very kind of policy level. The other, the harshest argument is that he receives more money from fossil fuel producers than any other senator. He also has a personal interest in the stocks he owns in a coal company. So that would be another thing that liberals argue against him. I think because you could argue that he's just representing the interests of his state, which, you know, would make him a skeptic of climate policies that would hurt his state. But on other issues, it's harder, again, for him to defend his positions, both on, for example, he doesn't support tax increases that were a part of one of the versions of what has become of Build Back Better. And he argued that he didn't like the tax increases because inflation was high. But presumably, it would be hard to find economists who would argue that lowering the deficit, which is what tax increases would do, that's usually the thing you do when you want to deal with inflation, is you would lower the deficit. So it's not clear how raising taxes increases inflation. I guess his argument is when you raise taxes, you always spend more federal money. But it's not exactly a clean argument. His arguments also on voting rights have been pretty weak. His argument being that he can put a deal together with Republicans to improve voting rights is not likely, given that Republicans have benefited in a number of states from changing voting rights laws, and Republicans in Congress are not going to undo what those states have done. Finally, the liberals don't like what he's doing because they don't like the fact that Joe Biden has a very narrow margin. I mean, this is, senators behave like this. It's just that expectations were too high for what Biden might be able to get through a Senate where he has such a very, very, the narrowest possible margin.
Is Manchin a villain, Josie?
I always try to keep in mind is that Manchin is probably the best senator we're going to get out of West Virginia. So the alternative is not like, you know, it wasn't between him and Bernie Sanders for who was going to be the next, you know, West Virginia senator. So it could be worse. But at the same time, I think he is constantly facing a battle between the likelihood of him getting reelected and doing the right thing. And he chooses reelection every time, which is like, what's the point to me? What is the point of having this job if you stand in the way of any real ability for the Democratic Party to make change and also for the Democratic Party to gain seats in the future, right? To be effective, to look like they're actually getting more done. I do think like it's worth noting that the healthcare provisions, this new quote, slim down reconciliation bill, which is not much of a reconciliation bill at all, are good. They're important, right? Like they matter. But the not just like his logic for rejecting important portions of the Biden policy goals, but also the way he has strung the party along and has just basically weaponized his power by extending talks for months because like he doesn't like an insult he read in the, you know, in the press, or like really just kind of holding people hostage, holding the party hostage. It seems like there's a better way to approach this, both in substance and procedure.
I guess I think that conclusion makes sense if you assume that Manchin, if you assume a kind of more parliamentary system, that Manchin as a Democrat has an obligation to go along with the overwhelming will of the party. I think Manchin thinks of himself as a different way. It's kind of in the way that senators used to think of themselves, as these kind of giants who are arbiters of what the country must do, and who act independently, and who act in both in the national interest and local interest, and in their perceived, you know, kind of their grand theory. I don't think that if you ask Joe Manchin, he would say, "Oh, I've refused to do the right thing out of my electoral interest." I think Joe Manchin would say, "I have looked at the policies the Democratic Party wants to pursue, and I don't think they are. I think they're wrong for the country and wrong for West Virginia." And so he's certainly supported lots of the Biden agenda. He supported overwhelmingly supported lots of the Biden agenda and voted for things. Like, that's how they're able to get 50 votes for some of the big bills they passed earlier. But he, you know, reached a point where he was like, I don't want to do this. And maybe it's cynical. Maybe it's because he's tied up in fossil fuels. And maybe it's because he is motivated thinking. He doesn't want to John's point about coal. That's really interesting that he won't look at what the scientists say about what's realistic or not, and that he reaches erroneous conclusions. And certainly his conclusions are economically illiterate. This fact that he doesn't want tax hikes because it will hurt inflation is crazy. It's just like the opposite of truth. But that said, like, you know, it feels to me it's really easy to pin the blame on Manchin, but this is a murder on the Orient Express. Like, there's so many different forces that are killing Build Back Better. They're killing climate provisions, killing that. It's not just, you know, he's the one that's easiest to pin it on, but it's also that Democrats, you know, fail to win majorities, bigger majorities. The structure of the Senate is totally messed up. Schumer bumbled this. Biden bumbled this. Like the Republicans, the poisonous nature of politics, like you can't get a Republican vote for anything has made it impossible. So I think that the pinning so much on Manchin and Manchin's villainy and Manchin's cynicism feels to me to be like it's scapegoating is very fun and easy and sure, but it really is such a larger set of manslaughters and murders that are taking place other than this.
But I would push back on the idea that he thinks he's doing what's best for the country and what's best for West Virginia. I mean, it's possible that that's true. It's also like it usually works that when certain things benefit people and benefit their pockets, they're suddenly they suddenly believe in them morally as well. And I mean, just looking explicitly at the climate change provision, like that ability to ignore the evidence and actually not examine what is good for the country and look around and see what we're facing and decide that the best answer is not to act. It's hard for me to believe that that is a purely judgmental ideological decision from someone who has simply studied the evidence. He has an investment in this, I think, both electorally and practically.
David, going back to your point, I think when you think about climate change, you know, focusing too much on Manchin has this other challenge that it poses, which is that the politics of climate change are difficult. I mean, Jay Inslee tried to run for president on a single climate change platform. And he was, I think, the first one to get bounced out of the Democratic primary, which is also combine that with the short-term, long-term issue we were talking about, which is that when it comes down to the things that have to be done to deal with climate change, it becomes more politically difficult, even outside of West Virginia. All of those things are a part of the complexity of climate change's politics, which turning Joe Manchin into a villain might obscure. And I'd also add that on the Republican side, it's quite true that on climate change and other issues, it's very hard to find any Republicans who will work with Democrats. But there are these issues where Republicans have worked with Democrats. I mean, I mentioned silicon chips, there's infrastructure, defense spending, same-sex marriage, they're probably going to get 10 votes for gun control. So it's not totally true that they won't vote for anything with Democrats.
I would note the headline this morning that Joe Manchin and Susan Collins seem to have a deal around reforming the Electoral Count Act and at least forestalling one of the worst possible outcomes of a presidential election. Not to say that their reforms would fix everything that Donald Trump and his lackeys are trying to break or have broken, but it would fix some small aspect of it and would prevent some of the chaos that we saw on January 6th in Congress from happening again. And it's an example where Manchin's place in the middle enabled him to get something done that people, Democrats value and Republicans value too. GabFest listeners, you know that we now do GabFest Reads, which is our monthly, that was my attempt at being you, John. That's our monthly special episode we drop, additional episode, where one of us talks to an author of a new book that we are excited about. And on July 24th, so this coming Sunday, Emily will be interviewing Vanessa Waugh about Waugh's book, Forbidden City. So check it out. It'll be in your GabFest feed, and listen to it there. The Dobbs decision has created both tremendous certainty in the country, the certainty that Roe is gone, abortion is now a state matter, and tremendous uncertainty. The mosaic across the country, or maybe mosaic is the wrong image, the Jackson Pollock nature of the state laws that we have has been a recipe for chaos and ambiguity and misery for some pregnant women. And at the same time, I suspect those who oppose abortion say, oh, we are protecting the lives of unborn children, or now the phrase that I'm now hearing, pre-born children, which is an extraordinary new phrase that abortion opponents are using. So, Josie, can you talk about some of the completely predictable chaos that has emerged since the Dobbs decision came out and states began taking their own action on abortion?
Yeah, I think it falls along like two different spectrums, right? The first is that we're seeing stories like the one that has gotten a lot of attention over the past few weeks of young people in particular being suffering through pregnancy because of rape, often because of incest, and not being able to access care. So there was the 10-year-old out of Ohio a couple weeks ago. I read something the other day that said, one provider said she's already taken care of 3 kids under the age of 12 since the Dobbs decision came down, right? So we are seeing like children, little kids. I mean, I have a 4-year-old and 10 is like, that just feels unfathomable, who are being told like something bad happened to you, but let's not make another tragedy out of it by getting an abortion, which is just so, I mean, I don't think I have to explain just how horrifying that is. The other thing we're seeing is, surprise, surprise, a lot of Republican legislators who have enacted these laws over the years to score political points when Roe was good law, don't actually understand how pregnancy or abortion work or what they mean. And so lots of people who have had miscarriages, who have had pregnancy complications, who have gone to, you know, have had ectopic pregnancies where there's still some quote unquote cardiac activity, even though there is no possible way the baby survives, nor that the mother survives if the ectopic pregnancy continues. You are seeing their suffering be dragged out for days and weeks more than it needs to be, and their health being at serious risk. I think the other thing that we're going to see, right, is a lot less people willing to do this, to do abortion, any sort of abortion-related work, including, you know, miscarriages. We're going to see providers much less likely to provide that service at all. And the result is already deaths of, and is going to be many more deaths of, people who need help.
Bridget, our researcher, was telling me just before we came on that there's a phrase in the Missouri law which says that you could treat a woman, you can have an abortion for someone whose fetus is dead or dying, and that Missouri removed the word dying. It was only dead, so that you literally now cannot, if you have a situation where this is an embryo that will die, but it has not died yet, you cannot treat that person. It's just crazy. But John, why do you think the anti-abortion movement has felt so emboldened post-Dobbs to push these laws that are much more draconian and without exception than laws that they talked about before, eliminating rape and incest exceptions, eliminating even protections for the life of the mother, laws that can be used to target contraception? Why do you think that politically that now seems doable? There's not an incentive for bipartisanship in state legislatures, and so, like, go for what you can. Grab anything you can get. Grab it all. And there's not a consequence for being extreme there.
Well, looking at it from the energy of the fundraising and the energy of the anti-abortion coalition that has grown up and been so wildly successful over such a long time, you can't build a machine like that and then just shut it off when you win. So the machine needs to keep going. part of it is motivated by people who believe that at conception, you are given a gift from God. So you have people who have that religious view, who don't lose that religious view, even though, which explains their position on rape and incest. Then you have other people who have made a career out of raising money this way and agitating for this position. And so winning breeds more efforts to win. I think what'll be really interesting beyond the all of the complexities we've talked about already is how far states push this question of punishing people involved in out-of-state abortions. So, for example, in Texas, Sidley Austin announced they would cover the cost of out-of-state travel for employees. So is Texas going to punish the law firm Sidley Austin, which is, as I recall, a rather big one?
They sent a threatening letter. AG sent a letter.
And so are you going to punish a big Texas law firm in that way? And then obviously also the other legal way this would work out is if is to try to keep punishing people who participate at all in helping with an out-of-state abortion. So if you were somebody who did a web search in the state of Mississippi to help somebody go to New Mexico, would that make you a part of a criminal conspiracy? And how that all plays out. One is just a legal question. How big can you define the conspiracy? The other is any firm that operates in one of these states and provides healthcare presumably would be crosswise with these laws. And that brings in the economic interest, which might make might change the calculus for some politicians.
I think a couple of things worth remembering here. One is like when Texas passed that law, that kind of reshaped our fundamental constitutional understanding of like of standing, of the legal idea of standing last year, and the Supreme Court did nothing about it. Texas politicians have not really suffered any political price for that, right? This idea that there would be a major backlash against politicians who are willing to support that law, but from moderate women, for example, that hasn't happened. That we haven't seen that. And so I think that's part of the reason that people are willing to take the gamble right now, because in many of these conservative states, they're not paying the price. They're just not seeing anybody pay the price for that. I think the other thing that like keeps me up at night about this is sort of the way in which it grows surveillance culture and the criminalization of women and pregnant people and people who may assist pregnant people, right? And how the fact that we had a Supreme Court that was not willing to reinforce constitutional principles when the Texas law was passed makes me believe they might not be willing to do the same if states do try to pass a law that they can criminalize you in Texas for getting an abortion in California. The ways in which this grows the punishment infrastructure, but also the infrastructure of control that benefits the government in so many other ways, I think is yet another reason that Republican politicians are supporting it. I mean, in a lot, it benefits them in ways beyond just pro-life votes at the ballot.
I think that one of the, again, totally predictable consequences, but really bad consequences of this is the climate of uncertainty for healthcare providers. Healthcare providers are now, in a lot of states, are now not sure what they can do. And because they're not sure, they are protecting themselves, which means they're refraining from providing the care that they wish to provide to women in distress because they're fearful, legitimately fearful, they will be targeted for lawsuit or prosecution. And this goes back to something which I think the Texas law really got to, which is I always felt like was a trait of Donald Trump's, which is that uncertainty is one of the biggest enemies that the world has. That uncertainty is the enemy of regular people. Uncertainty is fear. And to create uncertainty in people and to make people feel like I don't know where I stand, I don't know what I can do, it's just cruel because it destabilizes people. It just makes people anxious and that's necessary. And two, it's just bad for the world because like it's in sometimes almost better to have a very bad law, but at least a law that you understand and is clearly enforced than it is to have a situation where you just don't even know what the law is and what could happen to you if you run afoul of it. And a lot of thing, characteristics of states like the Soviet Union in its bad times. It wasn't so much that every law was different than the United States' law, is that it was very unpredictable when and how they would be enforced. And I feel like that's what we've done with teachers. That's what we're doing with doctors and healthcare professionals in around things now around abortion and maternity care, with teachers around teaching of race, teaching of sex, teaching of gender identity. And it's bad. It's bad, bad, bad.
Abortion doesn't seem like one of those issues to me where it's sustainable on a state-by-state basis. That, like, part of the reason Roe was so important was because we recognized that that there was no middle ground on this, almost. That there was not going to be just satisfaction with, well, let the states decide. Pro-life activists have said this. They've said, we're not done. We will not stop until there is a federal ban on abortion. And I find in my cynical moments that much, much, much more likely right now than I find the possibility of a Roe-like infrastructure coming back. And even if it does, right, you have to build up that expertise again. You have to find doctors who can provide these services again. You have to train them. You have to make abortion not only legal, but available. And I feel worried about the future, even beyond just a state-specific laws. I feel worried about it because I'm not sure that any state will have that right in the near future.
The AP did a story where they looked at, they took a set of figures. It was very good. I would have picked some other figures, but they basically looked at individual states and they looked at the percentage of children in poverty, the participant in the Women's Infants Children Federal Assistance, basically welfare program, the rate of child abuse or neglect, women experiencing intimate partner violence, low birth weight, women receiving no prenatal care, and uninsured children in poverty. And they used those as the measure to look at health of children. And what they found, of course, was that some of the hardest places to raise and have a healthy child are the states with the strictest abortion laws.
You know, if we were actually talking about not just providing a future for unborn babies, right, but providing, not only providing a future for unborn babies once they're born, but even giving unborn babies before they're born the best chance. There are so many other ways to do that and to make that, to help that than punishing women who want abortions. Ultimately, this is how we work. We punish people rather than incentivize them, right? We punish people rather than support them for doing what we want them to do. Punishment is a really, curbs a lot of behavior.
Let us go to cocktail chatter. John Dickerson, when you are having a cooling cocktail on a New York rooftop, a New York patio, a New York living room, what will you be chattering about with your beloveds?
The story of the Secret Service and the text that they had not turned over to January. It is so bonkers. It's just bonkers. So here's the thing that to me, so the Secret Service was asked to give information from 24 Secret Service personnel between December 7, 2020 and January 8, 2021. And they turned over one text, which was a call from the U.S. Capitol Police to the Secret Service as the Trump supporters were attacking the Capitol. One text. I mean, my kids don't respond to my texts, but even they send more texts than that. And it's just amazing. And the shifting number of explanations from the Secret Service as to why they don't have the texts from that period, because they were all erased during they've changed their, it was one point, it was that they were, they, there was nothing relevant, which makes no sense at all. Second was that there was an upgrade of the systems. And both at one point they seemed to say it was an upgraded systems and sorry, everything was deleted afterwards. But then they also said that agents were supposed to upload anything they had from that period and they just didn't do it. As Stephen Colbert joked, the next explanation is going to be that the dog ate the texts. But then what we learn is actually back in February, a watchdog agency in the Department of Homeland Security knew about all this in February. that these texts were gone, which adds another like kooky, and didn't tell the January 6th committee. I mean, I'm left only with more questions. I don't know. It just, I don't see how they can give the answers they did in a self-respecting way in this modern world that we're in. I mean, I can understand if this was like 1991.
Josie, what is your chatter?
My cocktail chatter. Am I allowed to say something by my husband? Is that like not
yeah.
allowed?
Yeah.
Okay. As long as your husband's okay
definite,
with it.
Definitely. Yeah. If he married him, he must be awesome.
I did. He is awesome. And puts up with me, which, it, you know, is not easy. And he works for New York Magazine, writes for New York Magazine, and did a great interview with Larry Wilmore. I think maybe it came out about last week. And I, you know, when it's so hard to find things that are like really engaging and interesting and also don't make you super depressed, this interview is one of them. He kind of traces his history in television since the early 1990s, maybe the 1980s. And it's fascinating. This is a guy who has like played a massive role, especially in Black television over the years. And it still has such an influence. And the interview is really great.
Do you want to say your husband's name?
My husband's name is Zach Cheney Rice. I taught him everything he knows. He won't admit that, but it's true.
My chatter, quickly, I did a really fun podcast with Josh Zepps, who's an Australian. He's an Australian podcaster. He has a podcast called Uncomfortable Conversations, very aptly named podcast, which is a extremely tense, direct conversation. He's just a really straightforward person, very funny, very smart. My actual chatter, though, the thing I was thinking about, what did I want to chatter about, and what have I actually spent the last week doing? And I've spent most of the last week truly watching the World Track and Field Championships. I don't know if you guys are fans. It is the World Athletics Championships are taking place in Eugene, Oregon, and the first time these championships have ever been held in the U.S. And so it's 10 days or so of track and field competition, and NBC and its affiliates and Peacock have all of it going. And it's fantastic. I cannot recommend it enough. I spent 4 hours the other night watching women's high jumping. The women high jumpers are weirdos. They're so weird. They all have these odd body manners, and they're always constant. It's a super psychological sport, so they're visualizing how they're going to do their jump, and you see it in person. And they also have these incredible bodies because they're all about like 6 feet tall and super angular and incredibly flexible, and they're amazing. And then there's the men shot putters, who are some other entire species of person, and the runners, who are so beautiful. Just watching these people run around the track, it's glorious. It is glorious. Listeners, you also have been sending us great chatters. You email them to us at gabfest@slate.com, or you tweet them to us at Slate Gabfest. And our chatter this week comes from Mark Wegner.
Hello, Gabfest. My chatter today is about the opening earlier this month of the archives of The Atlantic magazine. Every issue of the monthly from 1857 to present is available in a well-organized place. The archive is searchable by topic, author, and date. I'm just getting started, but I've already found interesting articles about the assassination of James Garfield in the November 1881 issue. Hat tip to Candace Millard's excellent Destiny of the Republic for sparking my interest in him. There's a profile of General Jeb Stuart from 1886, and an August 1939 man on the street interview with Germans convinced of Hitler's peaceful intentions. Contemporaneous history fascinates me, and I think you'll find it interesting too. I love the show. Thanks for the opportunity.
I'm also so excited about these archives. I just, I'm thrilled. This is like how I like to spend my Saturday nights. I spend a lot of time on newspapers.com just searching old topics. So this opens up a whole new world.
I do this tour. I lead this tour of the Civil War fort in DC. And one of the highlights, and I have some materials, written materials, is there's a battle that took place in DC in 1864. And Abraham Lincoln went to this battle, and Harper's, what we now know as Harper's Magazine, covered it. and there's an etching of Lincoln at the battle, or a depiction of what Lincoln would have looked like at the battle, which I show to everybody. And it's always good for a laugh because it's a very artistic, there's a lot of artistic liberty taken. But I love the idea, like this thing, just it's the same form that we read today. You know, we still read magazines today and we look at it, and it's meeting the same emotional, psychological, intellectual need as it did 150, 170 years ago. That is our show for today. The Gabfest is produced by Shana Roth. Our researcher is Bridget Dunlap. Our theme music is by They Might Be Giants. Ben Richmond is Senior Director for Podcast Operations. Alicia Montgomery is the VP of Audio for Slate. Please follow us on Twitter at @SlateGabFest and tweet chatter to us there. For Josie Duffy Rice, the always delightful John Dickerson, I'm David Plotz. Thanks for listening. We'll talk to you next week. I think Emily will be back. Hey, Slate Plus, how are you? We have a topic inspired, I think, by Bridget about childhood and summer, and particularly what memories stick with us from childhood summer and why they're important and what we learn from that or how that shaped us. Anyone want to start? Josie, do you want to start?
My main memory of summer is going to visit my grandmother in Minnesota, where we would stay with her for weeks at a time. And she's 92 now. She has Alzheimer's. She lives here in Atlanta now. But one of my main things I remember is that she lived on the 20th floor of a building. And one day the elevator was out. And she must have been 60 at the time. And we climbed up those 20 flights of stairs. And this actually wasn't particularly good memory, but it was I do think of it all the time because it reminds me to get in shape. My 60-year-old grandmother took those 20 flights of stairs like it was nothing, and I...
That was just a snippet from our Slate Plus conversation. If you want to hear the whole conversation, go to slate.com/gabfestplus to become a member today.